Session number 824.
This is Mike Knight interviewing Jim Brown in August 1976 at the meeting of the International Brigaders at Stamford Hall in Leicestershire. Jim, you were a member, as you've mentioned to us, of the Marseillaise Brigade, and I shall particularly want your stories related to personal exploits with the International Brigade, but I wonder if before this starts you could give us some idea of your earlier life and some of the activities you took part in which led you to taking part in the Spanish War.
Yes. I was born the 1st of the 2nd, 1907. It's a long time back. I was brought up as a Roman Catholic. Went to Catholic schools, and I found them rather harsh. Matter of fact, they drove the Catholic religion into me so much, they drove it right through me. By the time I was three, I had spent 2 years in hospital having 19 operations for a burn, which extends, as you can see, from the top of the neck right the way down. And of course, in those days, we're going back nearly 65 years, the method of treatment was a bit more primitive than today. But nevertheless, they did a good job, and I'm thankful for them. So, following on that, our life was of deep poverty. And when I say deep poverty, I mean deep poverty. There were occasions when I was five, my sister six, when we went days without food. As a matter of fact, it's sometimes in the summer we walked the streets all night where we lived at King's Cross, because next door was a rag shop and the rats ran over the bed at night, so we dare not go in. Anyway, pass over that period, as you must, and I had half a dozen brothers and sisters, some of whom died due to conditions. I think about three of them died. But nevertheless, eventually there were six surviving brothers and sisters. But from my point of view, we moved. We were evicted from home 11 times for non-payment of rent, which in those times meant the furniture being thrown on the street. This was quite common, because the neighbours used to gather around to help. But anyway, none of this is really important, but it does tend to create a certain attitude, either consciously or unconsciously, in the individual, because he must reflect some of this in later life. That is my view. I can be wrong. But I had a great passion for running and football sport, and I spent as much as 10 hours a day sometimes as I got older playing football and running, and I really enjoyed it. I also had a great liking for poetry, for writers, for some thinkers. I read some of the philosophers, most of the writers, and I suppose I've read books by them, almost 100,000. I like Shelley as a poet. I like the more, obviously I like Gray's Elegy, The Deserted Village, Oliver Goldsmith, and many fragments of poetry which appeal to me, whether it's due to my background or not, I wouldn't know, but there was a sense of beauty about them that did appeal. Anyway, I eventually left school and worked. I worked for a firm in Edgeway Road. We did, I'm talking about 1922, just after the police strike, after the First World War, in which things were fairly bad, as you know. And we received, quite a number of us lads received a princely sum of 15 shillings a week, and we did a 12-hour day for 6 days a week. And one Christmas Eve, I worked, I was on one of the old T-40s at the time, delivering, from 8:30 in the morning till 4 o'clock the next morning. It worked out at 3 halfpence an hour. Now, this is in the 20s. 3 halfpence an hour. And one of our dames was to phone the firm up and say to them, get down to the docks quick. There's a consignment of slaves just arrived from Africa. This one about gags. But of course, we took a bit of an hiding there. Now, then, after a period of other small jobs, I worked for a firm, fishmongers in Mayfair. I delivered at the house of the really rich. Solly Joel, J.B. Joel, Oppenheimer, the Diamond Kings, the Duke of Westminster, 17 people working in his kitchen at home, 8 of us trying to manoeuvre 3 bloaters between us for dinner. And you saw this terrific contrast. Although it didn't really sink in at the time, you accepted this as part of life. But the more I read, the more I began to see things a bit clearer. And I began to read Social Conditions. I dabbled in Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, Ricardo, Surplus Value Economics, Philosophy. I especially liked some of the lighter writers like Carol Capek, and The Bluebird, The Insect Play, Maeterlinck. I read some of the Russians, Pushkin, many writers, some good, some bad. Most of what I read was rubbish. Nevertheless, some stuck. And Robert Blatchford's Merry England, I got hold of a copy of that at the time. Jack London, I think lots of people read like Jack London. And a book, of all the books, The Annual is quoted a lot, but the book that came home to me most, which was written by Jack London, and almost one of the books, real books that did have reality in it, was a book called People of the Abyss by Jack London, which dealt with London, and it dealt with a part of London I knew, and from my experience, it was true. It was true. But nevertheless, I went in the building game, and in that game, you worked in the summer, you starved in the winter. And towards the end of the summer, around the squares of the really rich, and I mean the really rich, Mayfair and that, where you work in the boats or up the ladders outside, when you heard the lavender sailors come along, they'd sing that song, "Will you buy my sweet lavender?" You knew the hard times were coming because the summer was coming to an end and you were going to go hungry for Christmas. You knew we were there, and you knew that summertime's work was over and that's it. But anyway, things got worse. They got really bad. And I was unemployed. I slept in Hyde Park once under the bandstand. I couldn't get enough money even for 6 shillings a week rent for a room. I did get a room, 6 shillings a week. Nice old dear, the landlady, very, very nice. Woman about 70, very nice. 15 pence a week it was at the time of Nimmer Golden Mutiny, 1931. The economy cuts. This country went off the gold standard. And it was reduced to 15 pence a week. Now, a man had to live on 15 and fourpence a week, feed, clothe, pay his rent. A married man with a child, he had 2 shillings a week for a child to keep that child, and his wife 9 shillings a week. And of course I joined the NUWM, fought for better conditions and winter coal for the unemployed and all that, but it still got worse and I couldn't afford the rent. So what I did, I used to wait till 1 in the morning, landlady's asleep, I used to climb up the drain pipe into my bedroom. 5:30, out again before she woke up. But of course she tumbled down. And I got in there one night and I couldn't get out. She locked the door. So I thought, this is dodgy. So I wrote a note and pushed it under the door and locked in. So of course she opened the door. She said, you shouldn't have worried about that, you can't pay rent. You can always pay it when you get a job. Of course it wasn't as easy as that. Anyway, we did a lot of work trying to organise the unemployed and various other things, and the game was bad. We still play. I used to play football for hotel teams half a crown a time. But after 26 weeks he was thrown off the dole, and there was a possibility he was sent to a labour camp at Belmont in Surrey or Hollisley Bay. But anyway, this is the years went by at this kind of existence. And it was vicious because you'd be on a building job and if you rolled a cigarette, the foreman would say, cut that out, those hands belong to me. didn't like your rolling flags, you took time. Anyway, the international situation got worse, and I, like many, were following it, saw the rise of Hitler, the burning of the Reich, and we knew the trouble was coming. We knew it was coming. And we knew by the nature of what was happening in Germany, Italy, Japan especially, that it was coming on a world scale. And we knew that it must be opposed, otherwise there's no holding it at all. It had to be stopped. And I think it could have been stopped in Spain. The Second World War could have been averted. The submarine bases would not have been available. The various resources were there. Hitler would have been faced with an hostile anti-fascist Popular Front government behind him, not only in Spain but in France. And I'd read a bit about Clausewitz, German military theoretician, in which he always maintained no war on two fronts. And I read Captain Littleheart, who was a military expert of the day, and Max Werner, the military strength of the powers. And I tried to fathom out the economics, Marxism. I tried to read Das Kapital, Ricardo, Adam Smith, various thinkers, and I found it very difficult. It wasn't easy. I spent 6 months trying to read Kapital, and it just was not easy. I'm thinking you've got to have a certain gift. But anyway, I mastered enough to know that what I believed emotionally, intellectually, was correct. Mm-hmm. And in reality, in the reality of the year I was living, the times I was living, it was doubly correct, because I could see that the price that would have to be paid if this thing went up was going to be terrible. So therefore, we've watched closely events, and when the Spanish Republic came into existence, we thought things had turned for the better. But with the advent, and I am jumping periods, I know, but with the advent of Franco and the rising of the generals, we knew that this was it. And of course, it wasn't only people like me, it was all across Europe, all across the world. People knew, and when I say people, I mean the ordinary person knew this was all wrong. And so you can oversimplify this in the sense of the goodies and the baddies, but in essence, it was very clear-cut. It was very clear-cut. So after that, the Spanish people appealed for help when Hitler and Mussolini had invaded and they were ferrying Moroccan troops over. They did appeal for help. So I decided I'll go. So I was pushed for money, obviously. Someone said, you better take a good pair of boots. They've got nothing there. So I bought a pair of boots, heavy boots, and I borrowed £3 and I applied for a passport, Selfridges 7 and 6, passport $1.50 fee. They couldn't get it. I waited weeks, and I went up, I said, what about the passport? They said, we don't know, have you a criminal record, are you insane? I said, no. They said, well, either you're a lunatic or a criminal, or some other reason. They're the only reason for me to think of. Obviously, I wasn't a peer, so I didn't qualify on those grounds. So they said to me, you better go to the passport office and see what's up. So I went to the passport office. And I get in there, and to my surprise, they called me Mr. Brown. I'd been used to, here, you come over here and do this. So I thought, how strange. They took me in a storeroom. I thought, this is unusual. You go for a passport. And the porter left me there on my own. Then a man in a grey suit walked round the walls looking round. And when he came to me, I turned my back on him. And he asked me a question and I ignored him. So, of course, I suspected him. Out he walked, the porter came in, he said, follow me, Mr. Brown, upstairs, and he took me into a huge office. A very long walk, and there was a desk on a dais, and at the side of the desk was a man writing, and a very portly gentleman sitting at the desk like this. And I had this long walk to him, and I sensed, oh, I mean, they're weighing me up now, well, because I've got so far to walk. And I thought, these two characters here, right, and I'm going carefully, taking it down in shorthand. So this was the impression I got. So I went up to him. Oh, Mr. Brown, I said, yes. He said, why do you want to go to Spain? Just like that. So I looked at him in amazement. Go to Spain? I said, I'm going applying to go for holidays. He said, why? I said, because I want to. He said, why this time of year? I said, well, I'm busy in the summer. So he said, no. He says, how much money you got? Actually, I won 3 quid. I said, £30. £30, he says. Do you think that'd do you, Rolity? Which it would, obviously, in those times. And he says, suppose you spend that £30 and come on a British taxpayer to pay your fare back as a distressed British subject. Now, this sort of man had been forced to live on 15 francs a week, couldn't handle 30 quid.
Jim, you made a point just that you were going because you worked during the summer. What particular period of time was this you're referring to?
This was getting on towards the winter when people didn't take holidays.
Winter of 36?
36. And he said to me, why take holiday at this time of the year? You see, because I'd waited weeks for this passport hadn't come and the summer was passing. So I pointed out, I worked during the summer. So therefore I had to take an holiday when it suited. And this was coming on towards November, which he thought a peculiar time to go for a holiday. Anyway, I said, can I have a passport? I said, I have a legal right to a passport. He said, well, that's up to us. I said, well, I want to go on holiday. He said, that's up to us. I said, I'll see my MP then. He said, you do what you like. I said, well, I'm entitled to go. And can I, as a British citizen, apply and get a passport? He said, that's up to us. That's your answer. I said, well, it's not too good, is it? He said, well, I'll tell you this. If you do go abroad without a passport, you'll find it very, very serious matter if you're caught, he said. He started quoting about the Foreign Enlistment Acts and revoking certain laws, and he said, I warn you, it'll be harsh. Okay, I said, I can't get a passport. No. He said, but just a minute, he said, I'll tell you what we do, I've sold it. You leave your £30 with us as a guarantee you'll come back and you can go. I said, but just a minute, how can I go on holiday when you've got my holiday money? So he pretended that, oh yes, yeah. So yeah, they didn't give me a passport. Mm. So the next step I took, I bought a day ticket to Dunkirk, I caught a train at Victoria, and there was a party of the British Legion visiting the battlefields at this time, and they got on the boat at Dover, and I walked on the boat with them as one of the party. I got off the boat with them. I got in their coach, and the captain was counting them, and I bent down to do my bootlace up. Of course, he didn't see me. He came and sat where I was, and he looked at me. What are you doing? Oh, I said, I'm getting a lift into town. It was pouring rain. It was 4 in the morning. I couldn't speak the language. I had about 22 bob. So he said, if I thought you were coming over here to join the Foreign Legion, I'd give you the authorities. I said, can't a man have a day out, I said, without being interfered with like this. So I got out of that. So I thought, I wandered around Dunkirk. Hey, it was a terrible morning, and I had to get to Paris. So I thought, I'll find a bloke that looks English at the railway station, ask him to buy me a ticket, because I couldn't speak French. So I wandered around, and I found myself wandered into the docks. And a couple of French police come up and asked me for my particulars identity. I said, I'm just having a day out, I don't know anything about where I am. So anyway, they were quite good. They said, that's all right, you go this way. Whether they knew or not, I wouldn't know. But nevertheless, I did meet a bloke in a cafe, and he bought me the ticket for Paris. I went to Paris. I went to an address I'd been given, the Place de Combes, and experience, of course, I told him.
Jim, the address that you've just given, where did you get it from?
I got it from King Street. I went to King Street and interviewed a man called Robson. I went to King Street and pointed out I was an experienced soldier and all the rest of it. But I got this address to go to in Paris, went there, and the records, and I told them I was in the territories and all that. Little, I didn't know what they didn't scout. So, okay. They said, see this man, and they brought the man out. Have a meal, then there'll be some taxis come pick up, and when you see this man on the railway station, follow him. Wherever he goes, follow him. So, had this meal, we come back, taxis there, and we went to the railway station. Round back, pass around your home with your boots, in case they had no boots in Spain. And we followed him. And to my surprise, there's about 200 people with brown paper parcels under it. I'm following this man. Oh, no, that didn't look to me. That looked to me like a bloody movie. It was so conspicuous. So then, well, it was. So then I saw a line of police come in the station. So I thought, this is dodgy. It's all these blokes. There's a line of police come through the station in the line, French police. So I thought I'd see an old man and woman. He was reading with his pince-nez and his wife there. I parted and sat between them and started muttering. And they're looking at me in amazement, and the police went right by. I wanted to give the impression I was with them. But anyway, I got away with that, got on the train. We got to Toulouse, and not to fill in too much unnecessary detail, we got to Perpignan. We had a miracle. Well, I think a mouse could have got through Hercules, that miracle. As long as you could see found a near lightning, you're through. So we passed through the medical. Then we went over the Pyrenees, and the next morning we were in a big, went into a big fort, Figaras, a huge fort, Figaras. And we were there for one night, slept in the underground kind of caverns, and we then caught the train for Barcelona, stopped at each station. People rushing out at each station, throwing oranges in the train and playing music, and all the way across France, incidentally, on this train from Paris, all the peasants in the fields and all the children at the level crossing, salute all the way across, because the atmosphere in those days was really terrific. Because they all knew what you were on this train, where you were going. I think you, Thomas, mentioned it as Train 77, the volunteers' train.
And they all gave the
clench fists. Oh, yes, all the peasants, all the way across France, and even at the level crossing where you are. They'd all gathered, children all, salute. Of course, they all knew. Well, this was 36. What happened afterwards, I wouldn't know. But we went down to Barcelona, we got out on the train, we went and had a meal, then back in the train to down to Albacete. And it was dark at Albacete, we stayed the night at the Grand Vier, then we got in truck, and we went to this village called Madrigueras. Out on the plain of near Albacete, La Mancha, I think, the plain where Don Quixote was written about. And a few English there, and did a bit of training, such it was. Walked up to the next village and walked back, and things like that. And a couple of days of that, we were regular troops. And one night they said, we're moving, the arms have come in. So on Christmas Eve, the French battalion we were in, incidentally, it was a French battalion in the 14th Brigade. The brigade was the 14th, Marseillaise Battalion. And away we go to Cordoba. We went to Albacete, got the train, went to Andújar, changed there, and away we went on Christmas Eve, 36. And we made our way to Andújar, we got trucks, and on the road to La Pera in Cordoba, these open trucks. And it was round about the early afternoon, the truck stopped, the commander LaSalle jumped out and he started shouting, "Avion, avion, pronto, pronto." So we all jumped out of the truck, crouched, side of the road in a ditch, and down come the planes, machine gunning. Of course, that was the first experience we'd had, it wasn't too good. Anyway, the planes machine gunned and they passed. And the world went round that one seagull, a chap called Seagull, was killed. That was our first casualty. So we were told then we advanced on La Pera. So the rifles we had were Ossian rifles made in 1860. And they took one bullet, and sometimes that wouldn't fire. Sometimes the rifle exploded. They were very, very small. We had six French Chaucer machine guns. In the first half, eight French Chaucer machine guns. In the first half hour, six of them just collapsed, and the other two, you could only fire single shots. They were useless. So, anyway, the order was, La Pera, we advance. We went down these little valleys and up, and the fascists were there, and they had some pretty good machine guns. We had these old-fashioned rifles, and we couldn't reply to them too much, and they started to hammer us then. And I could see out of my corner of my eye blokes going down, and they were dropping. Mm-hmm. and they asked no more on, and still we pressed forward, they still we lost men, and still they had good guns. But anyway, we pushed forward until Nathan, who was in command, said, look, get out. We've got to get out. If we don't get out quick, we're lost. We'll all go, because we're practically surrounded. And it began to get dark. So some chaps laid down and started to fire. Although the rifles weren't all that good. But some of them, like Joe Hinkson, had experience fighting in China. Others had had experience fighting. And they said, don't fire in the twilight, and they'll see the flashes and that's your lot. So back we came, and we passed some of the dead and wounded. And all the buttons had fallen off my trousers. It wasn't fear, it was just lousy bloody buttons. And I thought, what an army. Rifles that are not much good, trousers that won't keep up, no grub, and I don't know too much what we're doing. So I thought, they ain't too good at all. I felt very unhappy. So, anyway, as we go back, I would like to say this. Hugh Thomas mentions in his book that some of them were retreating rather too hurriedly, which was understandable, which is true. And Nathan halted them and redressed them and redressed files, etc. But what happened where I was as we were going back, we passed a wounded bloke. And the chaps decided to take him back. And Nathan said, look, get out quickly or we're all lost. And the chap said, no, he's our comrade. He comes with us, he's wounded. And they've refused. And that's what actually happened. Well, that's, Hugh Thomas is confused with that, I wouldn't know. So we took him back, but he died on the way back. So we got back, it was dark, the fighting stopped. And we had lost a few, John Cornford, Ralph Fox, quite a few others.
This is an interesting point, Jim, particularly the three names you've given, Nathan, Cornford and Fox. Could you perhaps at this stage give us some indication how you found these three people?
Yes, I can. Bear this in mind. We weren't together very, very long. Matter of fact, we didn't have sufficient training very, very long. And things moved very fast, and what could have taken years was compressed in a matter of a few days or hours. I was with a little group speaking to John Cornford, and he had fought, as you are aware, in the early stages in Madrid. And we asked him, what was it like? He said, well, he said, it's a matter of time before you get it. Now, John Cornford knew it's just a matter of time, because he had had the experience of what you were really up against, and that was his view, which was born out of Cordoba. Mm. Now, Ralph Fox, a man of great culture, he wrote the history of Genghis Khan, didn't he? He was a very gentle man, a cultured man. He had an air of culture and gentleness. Very nice man, easy man to get on with. And he carried his talents so lightly and easy. He's a man anyone could talk to with ease, as an equal. That was my impression of Cornford and of Ralph Fox. Cornford, a good-looking chap, very young, of course. Ralph Fox was 36, Cornford was 21, and he was a gifted poet, as you know. Mm-hmm. And I must say, Cornford had nephew, Ralph Fox, he was just a gentleman. Perhaps in harsh time, but perhaps he had a steel underneath his gentleness. But anyway, they died, and that night it was very bad, because when we'd advanced on La Pira, there were supposed to be the French on the right, the Spaniards on the left. We didn't see anybody. We came back, and as it got daylight, we lined the crest then, and these bloody rifles, they were useless. Matter of fact, you threw it at the enemy, you might have done more damage. So, and as soon as it got daylight, the enemy planes came, and they really went for us.